And our text this morning is Matthew chapter 5, verses 21 through 26. And as Jesus continues on this Sermon on the Mount, last week, remember, he talked about what's needed is a righteousness that exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees. And now for the next few weeks, he's going to give us little glimpses of what that kind of righteousness looks like. And so this is our first glimpse here this morning from Matthew chapter 5, verses 21 through 26. This is the word of the Lord. You've heard that it was said to those of old, "You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says, 'You fool,' will be liable to the hell of fire. So if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you are going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge, and the judge to the guard, and you be put in prison. For truly I say to you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny." This has been the reading of God's word. You can be seated. How would you summarize our culture? I realize that's a really dangerous question because it usually reveals an awful lot about ourselves. Have you ever complained about sitting in traffic and someone says, you know, you don't actually sit in traffic, you are traffic? It's always annoying, but it's also kind of true, isn't it? It's same with looking at the broader culture. It's too easy to say, well, that's the culture, as if somehow, magically, we have managed to remove ourselves from any kind of influence, even that we might bring to culture. And so how would you summarize our culture? If you were to put this day and age, this society in a time capsule, maybe you might define our age as the age of technology. Even the workplace is changing so rapidly because of technology. Who knows what kind of jobs are going to be around in the next 10, 15 years? It's staggering and kind of scary how fast technology has developed in the last 25 years. You might define our age as the age of social progress. I don't think that's all bad at all. In fact, a lot of it is really good. Have we ever had such a global concern for human rights? You just can't roll your eyes at that. How about our particular subculture? Is this the age of busyness? Despite the technological advancements that are literally designed to make life easier, it seems more often than not we feel defeated and beat down and exhausted. All of these are true. All of those are right at the top of the list. But I think this is the age of anger. We live in an angry age. A book was written last year with the subtitle, "A History of the Present." How would you title a book about the history of the present? I think the way this book was titled, "The Age of Anger." There's populist anger. There is conservative traditional values anger. There are progressive values anger. There are youth sport parent anger issues. Cable news networks are basically like fireplace bellows, the tool that's used to just keep feeding air to the fire. Study after study shows that social media usage is a likely indicator of the decline of subjective well-being. Algorithms are created to attract our attention, give us that surge of dopamine in our brains so that we will react. We are the age of anger. It's everywhere. I was spending time with a buddy who's a school administrator. Most of the time that at his job, it's angry parents who unsurprisingly make angry children. I remember my experience in college working retail. I had so many angry customers, and guess what? A lot of angry coworkers. How about road rage incidents? Many of you know that I used to work in the auto insurance industry, and some of the most bizarre calls would be with the road ragers who are looking back over this big, dramatic, stupid accident, and they're trying to save face. And you just sit there trying to writing notes that are really funny, but also wondering, like, how did you put your family's life at stake through this kind of anger? We live in an angry time. And yet maybe we need to proceed with caution because maybe every time is an angry time. Maybe we're just an angry species. Dallas Willard writes, "To cut the root of anger is to wither the tree of human evil." That sounds so dramatic, but I think there's so much truth there. All of the evil in the world at some level is traced back to anger. Forget about world peace for just a second. Start talking about home peace. And it's at this point in Matthew 5, Jesus jumps in and he tells us what kingdom life looks like. It looks like the law of God, the perfect expression of God's righteous character, the good creation made, the wonderful, peaceful, non-violent, joyful, loving existence that we were created for. And as we'll see every week for the next few weeks, and what we can't lose sight of is that Jesus brings us to see the utter perfection and righteousness of the law in order that we flee to his work, that we flee to his cross and his perfection and his righteousness. And so Jesus is going to take us to the heart of the matter for the next few weeks. He's going to take us to the heart of the kingdom, and he begins today with anger. He takes up the sixth commandment. You shall not murder. And as a master teacher, he gets to the heart of this law. And we'll look at three aspects of the way he brings this word to bear on our lives, of what anger means, of how it relates to the sixth commandment. He explores the root of wickedness. He looks at the requirement of the law. And finally, he shows us the rule of the kingdom. He goes to the root, the requirement, and the rule. The root of wickedness, the requirement of the law, and finally he shows us the rule of the kingdom. Jesus begins working through the law in a remarkable way. He says in verse 21, "You have heard it said to those of old, 'You shall not murder.' And whoever murders will be liable to judgment." It's already a profound beginning to Jesus' teaching of the law with this wording that he will repeat. "You have heard it said, but I say to you." Remember, fulfilling Moses' law doesn't mean abolishing Moses' law. It doesn't mean ignoring it. It doesn't mean contradicting it. Moses said, "You shall not murder." Jesus doesn't say, "Go ahead and murder." He's not contradicting Moses. Fulfillment means getting to the heart of the law and seeing how, like a map, it leads us along the path to Jesus himself. And so what is he doing? Well, you've heard it said by the teachers of the law, "You shall not murder," because you'll get in trouble with the courts. You'll be condemned judicially. And therefore, as long as you're not murdering, it's all good. And like a Girl Scout or Boy Scout, you can slap the murder merit badge on your sash. And Jesus says in a profoundly offensive way to his original hearers, "But I say to you." He doesn't quote any supporting authorities. There's no argument, no reasons, no justification. There are no scriptural proof texts. He remains all alone. "I say to you." He locates the authority of what he is saying in himself. If I ever start talking like this, you just slap me upside the head. You talk to the elders. Jesus is saying, "I know this is what the religious authorities are teaching. I know this is what you're hearing from the teachers of the law and the keepers of the tradition, but I'm telling you something more important, something that is more real and authentic and true, and it's not because I had a vision, it's not because I heard a unique word from God, it's authoritative because I am saying it." And Jesus goes from murder to anger. Jesus has the scalpel, and he's doing the surgical work of exposing the depths of our need, and he does this by revealing the root of wickedness, the root of wickedness. "You have heard it said, 'I'm all good. I haven't murdered anyone.' But I say to you that if you're angry with your brother, you stand liable before the bar of God." He turns his attention to the motives and attitudes which underlie an act like murder. Anger is complicated. I mean, really complicated. Anger is good. Anger placed in our hands is almost always bad because it exposes the idols of our heart. Anger is a great thing. Anger almost always in our hands becomes a bad thing because it exposes the idols of our hearts. Anger is good because it is our natural, visceral gut response to that which is wrong and unjust. And so when you hear about child abuse, there is a correct response. It's anger. A school shooting, anger. Racial injustice, anger. And if you aren't angry at these kinds of things, that says more about you, that your moral compass is slightly skewed. Take it home, though. Parents, how do you feel when your child is bullied? As the nurturer and the sustainer and the advocate of your child, there's a correct feeling. It's anger. How do you feel when you get passed for the job promotion you were promised? The job promotion that you had earned, the one that got taken by the boss's nephew. You feel a little angry. The problem, of course, is that anger, which might not be bad in itself, and in fact, so often is a very good thing, in our hands becomes bad. The church father, St. Augustine, has such an immense quote. He says, "Hope has two beautiful daughters. Their names are anger and courage. Anger at the way things are, and courage to see that they do not remain the way they are." I mean, isn't that beautiful? Hope has two beautiful daughters, anger and courage. The problem's not with anger, the problem's with us. What happens is we lack the courage to seek healthy change, and so it becomes toxic. Some of you I know are terrible cooks. That's not me being judgmental. That's me just affirming what you say is, do not ask me to bring dinner. I'll get some takeout and we'll show up. We'll be fine. Those of you who are bad cooks, you just imagine being bought this beautiful, dry-aged Wagyu ribeye steak. And you're given this steak. The steak by itself, one steak, costs like $50. And so you throw it on your counter. It gets nice and warm. And the blood starts running on the counter because you don't know about food safety. Then you light the grill up, and it's all greasy, so the flames are just crazy. And you burn it to a crisp so it tastes like an ashtray. That's anger. Anger is good. Anger is beautiful. But you took the anger, and you put it on the counter and let it get unsafely warm. And you threw it on the fire. And Jesus says, everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. The idea here in the grammar is carrying anger. Whoever remains angry, whoever nurses a grudge, whoever harbors resentment. There are two Greek words to express anger. One Greek word is like the way a piece of straw is just consumed immediately. The second word is the word we have here. It's long-lived anger. To use the illustration or to keep it going, it's the anger of the man who nurses his wrath to keep warm. Anger arises spontaneously. We react to that which is wrong. But so often we receive the anger and then we indulge it. We explore it. We let its teeth sink into us. This whole idea was vividly brought to my mind a few months ago when I did something that absolutely none of you should do. And I mean this. Do not go to Costco on the weekends. I went on a Saturday. It's the worst idea ever. We parked and everyone just looked angry and impatient, which is so bizarre that you would go to Costco on a Saturday and not resolve to be more patient. And at one point, we're in an aisle looking at something, and my middle child, David, who is 4, he starts to just meander off, and he's in the middle of the aisle. And all of a sudden, this lady turns the corner. She's going super fast with her cart, and she stops on a dime. And she looks at us and says, "You need to watch your kid. He almost got ran over." Anger. Because something bad happened, right? Injustice. And then I started to indulge the anger. I mean, the adult with a large metal cart has the higher duty of care than a stationary child. There's a confusion of active subject in there. You almost ran over my son. He was standing still. He didn't almost do anything. And I kept indulging it. What can I say that will make you feel little? What words can I produce that will cause the most damage to you? I took my response to that which was wrong and I turned it into something worse. I didn't say anything, but it ruined my day. Anger is good. It's usually bad in our hands because anger exposes our idols. Why are we angry when we know that it's harmful? It was toxic to me. My day was ruined. It's because most of the time, anger has in it an element of self-righteousness and vanity. Why do I want to make this lady feel small? Because it makes me feel big. You say something snide to me, and I want to respond not with words that will be snide back, but to make you feel worse, because I'm justified. Think of an iceberg. About 87% of an iceberg's mass is under the water. And so just a little part of the iceberg is sticking out for all of us to see. It's like anger. What lies beneath the surface? The angry words and the looks and the aggression are all just poking out. But what sits under the water? It's our idols. It's our pride. It's our desire to be liked. It's our people-pleasing. When I get angry and my children receive the iceberg of my harsh words, it's because submerged is the iceberg of my idols of pleasure, peace and quiet, of respect. How many times do I have to tell you, where is my word of authority? Anger can be, and so often is good. In our hands, it's almost always bad because it reveals our idols. And that is ultimately deadly. We can think that the anger that lives in and builds up in our hearts, or the anger that might be expressed with some mere words, is trivial and not that important. But Jesus says something totally different. He says anger that is carried and nursed, anger that is indulged, is worthy of judgment before God. This is so far-reaching because it nails all of us. As one writer puts it, Jesus reproves even what we think are our most normal and everyday feelings and words. We are in the dock. Human nature is sick. That's the root of wickedness. That's where Jesus takes us. And he does this in particular, job of seeing the root of wickedness, by next moving on to the requirement of the law. What is the actual requirement of the law? How does he do this? Well, he contrasts what the teachers of the law had been promoting. You shall not murder, lest you be liable to judgment. The Pharisees seem to have taken this command as something purely legal. If you commit murder, then certain consequences will follow. Don't commit murder. Don't receive the consequences. Check, you've kept the law. And Jesus goes deeper. Everyone who is angry with his brother is liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council. And whoever says, you fool, will be liable to the hell of fire. Again, Jesus claiming the authority to give the true and full interpretation of the law. The requirement of the law, first of all, doesn't just have to do with our legal consequences. The heart of the law is about human flourishing, and as we see here, it's flourishing in a context of people, of relationships. Our first work in the world, the fruit of our relationship with God, is our work in the relationships with others. Something we'll see time and time again is that keeping the law is not all about you and your personal relationship with God. It's just not. It's about taking that relationship and seeing how it flows into your relationship with others. So listen to the severity of the law. Whoever is angry with his brother, whoever carries resentment toward his brother, if you have a King James Version or some kind of other, based off the King James Version, it will say, whoever is angry with his brother without cause will be liable to judgment. The problem is that that's not what it says. That comes from an interpretation that tries to soften what Jesus is saying. It's mitigating Jesus' demand. Of course, we shouldn't be angry for no reason, but that's not what Jesus is saying. He's saying you cannot harbor resentment, full stop. Jesus is saying whoever carries anger toward his brother is liable before the courts just like a murderer. It's kind of a silly argument Jesus is making. Of course, a court or council is not going to prosecute you on an internal motivation. That's fine, because look at the end. You're liable to the bar of God. And Jesus continues, the fruit of carrying bitterness and anger is our words. We drink the poison, which is our anger, but at some point, we got to vomit it out. Those are the words, accusations, insults, verbal arrows. It's hard to know if there's a difference between the two insults Jesus lists. They most likely refer to the head and heart. The first one is racha. It means empty-headed, harebrained, blockhead, numbskull, bonehead. The word probably comes from the sound of collecting spit in your throat before you do spit, right? The racha. On the other hand, it's fool, but fool in the biblical sense. Not fool as in stupid, but bad character, scoundrel. Two words of abuse that the fruit of your anger, you stupid scoundrel, you dumb scoundrel. These are not words that are so bad that you're going to get sued, even in this honor and shame culture. They're kind of like the way we would use them. They're just very insulting. You don't call someone a dumb scoundrel. Our lips release what lies in our hearts, and it's destructive. And one of Jesus' insights here is that anger or contempt doesn't have to be acted out in an extraordinary way to be evil. It just is evil. The words don't make it poison. The words release the poison that's already eating you inside, that which is already withering your soul, that which is already deadly to others. But before it does its destructive work in the lives of others, it's doing its destructive work on you. We live in a world, I know I say this a lot, but we live in a world of accusation and condemnation. We are so naturally bent on measuring ourselves against others than seeking their good. We look people up and down to measure their weaknesses, to look for how they don't measure up to us. And Jesus says, you are invited to something better. My kingdom. A kingdom of love and redemption secured because Jesus stood for the accused and he took upon himself our condemnation. We love to knock down our neighbors so we can boost ourselves, and Jesus says, that's just not part of my kingdom. That's the kingdoms of this world. See, in my kingdom, you are so free and loved that there's not an accusation in this world that can stick. There's not a condemning word that made it past my death on the cross. And so we're invited into a better righteousness than anything the world offers. A righteousness achieved not through measuring sticks and scales, but to an empty cross and an empty tomb. It's all about a righteousness that exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees. The requirement of the law, the requirement of the kingdom is so far beyond, you shall not murder. It's to provide life. I love what the Westminster Larger Catechism says about this commandment, because the positive duties mean not just preserving life, that's great, that's true, but charitable thoughts. Love, compassion, meekness, gentleness, kindness, peaceable and courteous speech. I think they totally got it, because what they are identifying are those things that give life. Are those attitudes and words that are life-bringing. And so if we hear what Jesus is truly saying, it slays us. There's no hearing Jesus say, but I say to you, and you get out your journal all excited and say, great, I can't wait to get these practices into action. He's reminding us of the perfection of the law that demands life-giving attitudes, intentions, actions, words, because it exposes our hearts. It leads us to despair in our own strength in order to find our confidence in him. Because to overcome a culture of death and judgment with love and life is difficult and it's costly. It costs you your pride. It costs you what's easy. And yet what makes the law a beautiful path of flourishing is that it draws us to Christ and to his work. It has to lead you to soak up the costliness of God's love for you. He who did not spare his own son, as we read earlier, what is he going to keep from you? At the cross, God's anger, his response to that which is unjust, was put on Jesus, so that in him, like a shelter and like a place of refuge, we might never experience or know or taste the anger and wrath of God. To live under the cross and to live out of the beauty and grace of a God who flipped justice on its head so that we might actually be free from the bondage of having to be right. And it's a bondage. He has broken our chains to the slavery of insecurity. Do we believe it? The requirement of the law is too much. It's why we're sent back to the beginning of the sermon. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are they who are helpless without God. Blessed are they who need God to act. And they are called blessed because he has. All right, Jesus brings us before God's perfect law, and he shows us the root of wickedness. He reveals the requirement of the law. And finally, he shows us the rule or the reign of the kingdom. It's one thing to be able to assess the heart of the law, but what does a life look like when you live according to God's vision of the good life? And Jesus says, let me give you some examples. Let's walk through this together. There's a pattern of how Jesus works through the law in the Sermon on the Mount. He gets to the heart of the command, and then he gives illustrations and pictures of what it looks like to live a kingdom life. So in our text, Jesus says, you shall not murder. It isn't about staying out of trouble by not murdering, but it's about your thoughts and intentions toward other people. And furthermore, through these examples, we'll see it's about seeking the good of others. I don't think these examples are hard and fast rules or laws. Instead, they give us an illustration. They give us a snapshot of life under the reign of God. So scenario one. All right, if you are at the temple and you're offering a gift at the altar, and then all of a sudden you remember that your brother has something against you, you leave your gift at the altar and you go. First to be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift after you have been reconciled or after you've sought reconciliation. Oftentimes you'll try to put this kind of story in modern terms. I think that's almost impossible to do here. Because this scenario that Jesus gives is insane. He's communicating to his audience on the Sermon on the Mount in Galilee. That's at the north of the country. He's communicating to an audience that if they were going to give an offering at the temple, they would have to go 80 miles to Jerusalem to the temple. And so he's saying a worshiper has traveled 80 miles to make this offering at the temple, and all of a sudden he realizes, oh no, someone even thinks I have wronged them. And so he leaves his animals. He takes the 80-mile journey back up to Galilee, seeks reconciliation, and then takes the 80-mile journey back to the temple to continue his offering. A kingdom heart cultivated to strive for peace, to not be content with the disruption of a relationship, even if it means being ridiculous. To do everything possible to heal what is broken. The point is not to make sure, sometimes they'll go here, right? Or maybe you've heard people go here. You're sitting in church and going, you know, let me go through my list. Am I cool with everybody? Don't make it a doable list. That's just more moralizing. Because Jesus is being way more big and demanding than that. He's painting a picture of a heart under God's reign. And so the improbability of the scenario is Jesus' entire point. The importance of right relationships demand immediate, decisive action. A kingdom person is the kind of person who is doing all the right things. You're at church after all, but you drop everything to go pursue the mending of a broken relationship. Maybe anger has arisen in response to something that is wrong, but the anger doesn't sit, it's acted upon. And so you do your part, you act in love, you seek reconciliation. You can't force the heart of the offended party to be changed, but you can reach out in love. I think the Apostle Paul is thinking along these same lines when he says in Ephesians 4, be angry, but don't sin. Did you hear what Paul said? Be angry. Remember, anger is a good thing. And then Paul says, but don't make it a bad thing. Don't carry the anger. Don't let the sun go down on your anger. Don't chew on your anger. Don't harbor and feed it. Give no opportunity to the devil. Right relationships demand action. Don't give the opportunity to the devil to take that anger that you're holding onto and you're cherishing, because he will make it into something bigger and more deadly than what even you're contributing. There's no hiding behind hypocrisy. I mean, what a fascinating example Jesus gives. Even if you are at the temple altar, even if you're at church, the kind of person that lives under my reign leaves to go make things right. You can't even hide behind religion. You can't hide behind some kind of super spirituality. This is scandalous. Kingdom living isn't let me get to my neighbor once the important stuff is taken care of. In Jesus' kingdom, it's all important. As another PCA pastor has put it, conservative theology has to lead to liberal loving. Then Jesus gives us a second picture of kingdom life. Come to terms with your accuser while you are going to court, lest your accuser hands you over to the judge and the judge to the guard and you be put in prison. Truly I say to you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny. First scenario seems like it's within the community of faith. The second is clearly outside. Jesus says, all right, you're being sued. Maybe you're in debt. A kingdom kind of person is willing to be wronged and settle. A kingdom person doesn't allow bad relationships to remain bad. In this snapshot, Jesus is upending the values of the world. Being right. Winning. Making out financially. Instead, it's all about acting quickly to heal that which is broken, loving our opponents and wanting to see them flourish. Does this mean that you can never sue someone? Wrong question. It's not what Jesus is talking about. It's harder than that. Does this mean that if I am sued, I actually can't pursue all the way to standing before a judge? It's not what Jesus is saying. He's not telling you what kingdom people do. He's telling you what kingdom, how kingdom people think while they're doing. And so the question isn't, can I go sue someone? The kingdom question is, how does my lawsuit exhibit love for God and neighbor? Am I covering up my relationship flaws with God talk and church going? As Frederick Dale Bruner has put it, Jesus' ethic is not heroic in being geared to unusual situations, but in asking for unusual Christians in all the usual situations. These are crazy scenarios, but they're not too far from our lives. And we are invited into this kind of kingdom life. As we wrap up here, by the end of Jesus' exposition of the sixth commandment, does it feel like you forgot where we started? Wait a second, I thought we were talking about murder. Kingdom righteousness makes the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, which, by the way, is the righteousness that we produce, it makes it look empty. That's the beauty of Jesus' message. His preaching of the law condemns us in ourselves, and it reveals our need, and it lifts our eyes to the good news that is offered, that in our need, we are met by the sufficiency of what Jesus provides. That's not all, though. It also presents the perfection and beauty of a kingdom that I'm telling you our hearts were created for. Because the legalist says, what do I need to do to love? And the follower of Jesus says, aren't you just tired of not loving well? I'm tired of not loving well. I want that Jesus purchased, Spirit-worked kingdom reality pressing into my world even now. And that's the vision of the kingdom that reveals Jesus. It's a picture of a righteousness that if you feel comfortable with, then you've totally neutered it. Because that wasn't what Jesus was talking about. But we're not hopeless because it's a picture of Jesus and his righteousness. He's talking about an anger that he never carried. And yet maybe in a funny sounding way, our very hope is in Jesus' anger. He lived a life so angry at death that he conquered it. He lived a life so angry at sin and sin's destructiveness that he would absorb it in his own flesh. We are saved by a righteousness that exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees. That's the good news this morning. A righteousness lived and breathed by Jesus, worked out painfully and slowly in our lives by the Spirit, but a righteousness that awakens our appetites for the very life of flourishing we were created to live, that we anticipate in the life to come. Let us pray.